Ladies and gentlemen, welcome to this evening's event. It's a great pleasure to welcome our guest this evening, Richard Clarke. Richard, without any doubts, is one of the most preeminent historians of modern Greece of his generation. Many of us have read his books and benefited from his telling of modern Greek history. Richard is an emeritus fellow of St. Anthony's College, Oxford. Of course, he spent many years just across the road at King's College, London, teaching Greek and Balkan history. Quite rightly, Richard has received a number of awards for his work on Greek historiography, the Greek history. He received the Runciman Award in 1993. He was awarded the Gold Cross of the Greek Order of Honor by the President of Greece in 2002. Having retired a few years ago, fortunately, he decided to write his memoirs, which, as you can see, have got the appropriate title, Greek to Me, a Memoir of Academic Life. So we've agreed that I'm going to open by asking Richard a number of questions, and then we'll allow plenty of time for your comments and questions subsequently. I should say that, as with all of our events, we have a Twitter hashtag, so you can make your comments as we go along. The hashtag is on the screen, hashtag LSE Greece. I would be very pleased to hear your comments. Tonight's event is also to be recorded and podcast, so people can hear it subsequently. And after we finish, after we've explored as many details as we can of Richard's life and work, there will be a reception outside, a wine reception, that I'm sure Richard would be happy to chat to you informally afterwards. And it's very good wine. It's LSE wine, which we're willing to offer you. And in fact, we're willing to offer you the wine on the basis of simply one condition. That is to buy a copy of Richard's book, which will be on sale subsequently. And I think Richard is happy to sign copies of the book afterwards as well. So without further ado, let me thank you for coming. We look forward to your questions and comments as we proceed. But let's start our conversation. Can you please join me in welcoming our guest this evening, Richard Clarke?
So, Richard, I wonder if I could just start by asking you about your your first or one of your first visits to Greece.
I was struck at the beginning of the book, you say that you finished Fettes College in Edinburgh, yeah. You're 18, you're given a travelling scholarship, a travel scholarship, and you decide to travel to Greece. You've got the intention of going to Asia, to be the first person receiving this scholarship to get to Asia.
Get to Asia, yes.
But you... you get to Greece, you do the usual things, you visit the classical sites, you go to Meteora, you go to Mount Athos, etc. I wonder if you could just begin by giving us your impressions at that stage. We're talking 60 years ago.
Yeah.
I apologize for mentioning it 60 years ago. A metaphorical figure, yes, 60 years ago.
Yeah.
As a young... Exactly, yes. British student, what was your impression on arrival of Greek society? Because you were looking at towns, villages, etc.
Yes. Well, my initial impression was how kind Greeks were. They went out of their way to assist me in various ways, some of them offering to put me up overnight and refusing to accept payment. And you have to remember that in 1960, I think the total number of visitors to Greece was about 250,000. Well, now isn't it something like 24 million a year? So it's a hundredfold. That's obviously had an effect to foreigners.
Yes.
young foreigners to a penny in visiting Greece, but this was not the case in 1958. And it sounds rather pathetic that I wanted to be the first person with the scholarship to visit Asia, but these were the days long before gap years were spent in Thailand or in China or various parts of the world. It really was quite an adventure to get as far as Greece, in fact.
And I remember seeing in your book that you went by train, and it took you 3 days.
3 days, yes. It was, but as I say, the overwhelming impression was, you know, what a friendly country it was, and I had no particular interest in Greece, but when I went to university in the following autumn, I wanted to learn more about Greece and Greeks. Yeah.
So if you didn't have a particular interest in Greece, how come you were travelling to Greece? Was the original intention that you would just simply carry on, that go through Greece onto somewhere else?
Yes, well, I really didn't have a great deal of interest in any, well, a general interest in travelling, of course,
yeah,
but not a specific one in Greece. But my real, beginning of my real serious interest in Greece was 2 years later in the long vacation.
Yes.
When I was taking a course in Byzantine art under Professor Talbot Rice, one of the pioneers of the study of Byzantine art in Britain, and he could see that I was interested in art history, and particularly Byzantine art history, and he asked me if I'd like to spend the summer helping to uncover wall paintings in a Byzantine church, which had subsequently been turned into a mosque in Trebizonda, and that sounded like a real adventure. Another, that was about a 4-day train journey getting Trebizond. It's actually, you still can't get to Trebizond by train, but you could get fairly near and take a bus over the mountains to Trebizond. And I must say, I found this work of uncovering the wall paintings rather boring, because, of course, when the church was turned into a mosque, the paintings were covered up and were covered in a sort of plaster, rather hard plaster, and we literally had to pick this plaster off with dental picks, the kind of things that dentists poke around your teeth with. And, you know, for about the first 10 minutes, it was exciting to see a tiny fragment of paintings that no one had seen for 500 years, but that soon wore off. But I became very interested in the exploring Trebizond itself, which was not a very beautiful city, really. It's still not a very beautiful city, but the countryside behind it was magnificent, and we used to, at weekends, go on various expeditions. And then, having done that, I became seriously interested, because I realized that Greeks and Armenians had lived in very large numbers in Trebizond until about 40 years before I visited it. And they were, in the architecture, there were certainly signs of this earlier Greek settlement in the town. So that, it was really 1960, not 1958, that was my
more formative
time. Yeah.
So you said that one of the initial impressions is the warmth, hospitality. Indeed, having studied in Scotland,
yes,
me coming from Yorkshire, I'm sure,
yes,
we would both appreciate free accommodation,
yes,
on many occasions.
Yes.
This is very endearing. But I wonder, when you look back, particularly at rural society in Greece, how would you paint that? How would you give us a mental picture of how it seemed to you as the young foreigner?
I didn't really have a great deal of knowledge or even interest really in that. I was on both occasions really looking at historic buildings rather than... one thing I should mention about uncovering these wall paintings is that at the time, in 1960, it was still a mosque. And we were on very good terms with the Hoxha, who was happy to see the wall paintings uncovered. But then when we finished the work, the mosque was turned into a museum, and a mosque, purpose-built mosque was built for the Muslims in the region. But then, so it was run under the Ministry of Culture as a museum until 2013, when the mosque was returned to the Muslims of the area, and for a time the wall paintings were covered up. They weren't covered up with the plaster, but they were screened off. And I rather mischievously thought of writing to the Turkish ambassador in London saying, well, I helped uncover these in 1960. In 2013, I'm going to help to cover them up. But I fortunately didn't write that. But now, apparently they have some system, electronic system, which means that at the hours of Muslim prayer, five times a day, they can switch on, and that blots out the wall paintings. And it occurred to me that this might be helpful in trying to deal with the Irish border problem. If you could
just block out.
Block out. But I haven't seen the whatever device this is, but it's obviously some very advanced bit of digital equipment of some kind, yeah.
Right.
So sorry.
No. So I was also fascinated in the book that you're back in Greece in 1966 and 1967.
Yes.
You're there on the 21st of April, 1967. You're there after the 1965 crisis, the political turmoil, etc. You're still relatively young at that time, but you're developing an interest in contemporary Greece and Greek politics.
Yeah.
Did you have a sense that there was some inevitability about the path to this kind of breakdown of the political system and the coup of April 67? Was there a sense of something was going to happen?
Yes, again, I seem to be giving the impression of being rather ignorant about matters, because by 64, but particularly by 66, 67, when I was in Greece, I was working on mainly Greek settlement in Asia Minor in fairly recent times. Mm. And I developed a particular interest in the Karamanlides, the Turkish-speaking Greeks for whom books were published in Turkish but with Greek characters. Mm. And this was rather an obscure subject, and I remember sitting in the Ethniki Bibliotheki there working on some of this material, and every evening there were huge demonstrations in the street outside. And I didn't really show much interest in this. But then I came to know well Nikos Economides and his wife, Veta, Byzantis Nikos Veta, an Ottomanist, come Byzantinist. And they began to explain what was going on, and I became interested in the political situation, And this interest really led to a change in my orientation from plowing along in this rather obscure aspect of Greek history, books in Turkish and Greek characters, into an interest in the contemporary political situation. And then that was reinforced, of course, by the actual Praxicopan, military takeover. It was very difficult not to live through the establishment of a military regime and not take a very considerable interest in it.
Can you remember waking up and hearing the news of the takeover, and what did you do?
Yes, I mean, I remember listening to the radio. This was in the British School, sometimes called the British School of Archaeology in Athens. And I was listening to the radio, and then there was a very charming, sweet young maid, and because they kept playing music, it was all, it should have been a news program, but it was just music interrupted by the odd announcement saying, you know, everyone should stay indoors and this kind of thing, and that was how I realized something was going on. But one of my other memories of that day was in the afternoon. First of all, then in the British School, a notice went up that no one should leave the building, and there was a danger of being shot if you did. And that was an invitation to myself and my wife to explore Athens. And we did go out. And
you ignored the warning.
We ignored the warning. And most people stayed inside. There was a certain amount of sort of panic buying. But we came back by lunch, lunchtime. By that time, the situation had become really quite unnaturally calm. And then, after lunch, four people from the British Embassy came up to play tennis on the court that we shared with the American school. And, you know, I thought this was a bit of an odd thing, the military rule taker. Because in those days, 50 or more years ago, people still had the view that it was not so much the Americans who were pulling the strings, but the British. And you know, I kept saying to my Greek friends, well, I can't imagine if the British Embassy is interested in playing tennis. You know, they're pulling the strings behind the junta. But of course, it could have been a very sophisticated attempt to put people off on the wrong.
It could have been.
Could have been. Yes.
It could have been a very sophisticated British diplomatic tool to play tennis whilst the world around you is collapsing.
Collapsing,
it sounds like a kind of British comedy, comedy, etc. But
do you remember that movie from about that time, Carlton Brown of the FO?
Yes, indeed.
That was rather
like that. When you're back in the UK, Douglas Dakin, quite an eminent historian, you'd been appointed to one of your early posts, and I think Douglas Dakin gave you some elderly advice as to what to do in response to the colonel's regime.
Yes, yes. He said I should be careful not to become too associated with the opposition, so to speak. But he was a nice man, a very distinguished scholar, but a very conservative figure. And when, towards the end of the Epitetia, the seven-year dictatorship, Spiros Marcassinis was prime minister, he rather ill-advisedly wrote a letter to Marcassinis saying, you know, that I've always admired admired your skills, and you know, but I'm hoping very much that Greece will return to democracy, etc., etc. Marcus, he produced a memoir, but I have the seventh volume, but I've never seen any sign of the other six volumes. And the seventh volume was about the military dictatorship. And he publishes at some length Dakin's letter to him, rather embarrassing. So anyway, I liked Douglas, but I didn't take any notice of his well-meant advice. I think that it might cause me some difficulties in my career, but soon after coming back, I did get a job at the School of Slavonic Studies in King's College,
which was the first post in a British university devoted to modern Greek history.
Yes.
I think, and it was shared between King's and Cease.
At the time.
You record in the book one of your competitors was Michael Llewellyn Smith.
Yes.
Subsequently became British ambassador in Athens.
Yes,
a noted scholar himself.
And absolutely, yes.
One of your colleagues is Philip Sherard.
Yes.
A very noted scholar.
Yes.
I remember reading his book about Greek East, Latin West, for example,
yes,
and the difference
yes.
between the churches. So at that time, as a young scholar developing a modern Greek history program, things must have been a relatively exciting time of developing such a program for the first time in the UK.
Yes, it was. And Philip Sherard and I shared a room at King's College in those days. You know, beginning staff and even quite established staff had to share rooms. And a memory I have with Philip Sherard was he was very interested in ecology, and he noticed, as I did, to outside the window of this cramped office that we had, there was a sort of chimney with the nuclear hazard sign on it. Neither of us were very happy about this. And we sent a letter to the powers that be saying, are we in any kind of danger? And I don't think we even had a reply, but someone along came with a paintbrush and a pot of paint and painted it out.
So whatever the risk, it wasn't a risk to be visible, but the risk itself might continue.
But I did, a few years later, read of appalling situation at Manchester University, where in the interwar period, people had been carrying out experiments with radioactive material, and there'd been a very high incidence of cancer among people working in the 60s and 70s there, because of the residual effects of the radiation. So it could have been that something rather similar was going on at King's. But anyway,
you survived very well since then.
Yes, and Philip lived for a long time. So
yes,
I think
yes.
we were saved by the paintbrush.
Yes. So you ignored the advice that Douglas Dakin gave you, not to become involved in the protests against the colonels, etc. And reading the book, I think one of the very strong impressions is how much you were a rebel at the time.
Yes.
And you clearly didn't identify with or mix with a Greek diasporic elite during this period. Yeah. You're something of an outsider.
Yes, although I did have contact. I mean, you're true, generally speaking, it was with the sort of left-wing opposition, but I did have quite a lot to do with Eleni Vlachou and Takis Lambrias, who, of course, were pillars of the conservative opposition, and I used to translate things for Eleni. And another person I knew fairly well at the time was Maria Caravia, who was had been a journalist on Katimir in the Eleni Vlachos newspaper and was in exile in London. So I did sort of see some of these people, but not with the Shabunas and people like that.
It seems what comes across in the book is that it seems to be a conscious decision to maintain some kind of distance from these people. I noticed later on you refer, even in the 1980s, you have this phrase of referring to the, quote, the self-styled leaders of the Greek community in London.
Yes.
It implies that there were these people and there's Richard, and I'm quite consciously maintaining my distance.
Yes, well, that arose because of this book I wrote, which is not the one that I've just recently published, but this is a book about the amazing scandal that followed the appointment of Arnold Toynbee to the coronation chair at King's College. This book was published in 1986. It became really rather rare, was recently reprinted, and they charged an amazing price of £32 for a very thin book. And I have no commercial interest in whatsoever in the book. And in fact, I got a very small royalty, which I donated to King's College to buy books for their Greek library in memory of all the people involved.
I wanted to come on to that. So the your interest in this, but perhaps you could just tell us in a nutshell what the scandal was with Arnold Toynbee and the being the holder of the first Corace chair at King's College. Just tell us.
Yes, it's a complicated story, but basically the then principal of the college, Ronald Burrows, was a very dynamic man. He'd be regarded as a sort of academic entrepreneur these days. He was instrumental in the establishment of the School of Solonic Studies, but his main interest was in Greece. And he was a classicist, but unusually for a classicist, he had a very considerable interest in contemporary Greece. He knew Venizelos well, and he wanted to establish this Corais chair, which was a chair, it's called the Corais chair or professorship of modern Greek and Byzantine history, language and literature. Well, that's an absurdly wide-ranging, can you imagine a professor of German with pointed with an interest in modern and medieval German history, language, and literature. It would be absurd. You'd need six people to do that job. And this has been one of the problems about the chair, because there was, when Toynbee was appointed, he was a young man, only about 30, had quite a brilliant academic record. He was elected to a fellowship of Balliol College in classics before he'd even graduated, let alone done a PhD or whatever is now required to get an academic job. He was elected some months before he took his final exams. But he, too, because of his experience during the First War, as a kind of government propagandist. He'd become very interested in Near Eastern affairs, and that, of course, included Greece. And he applied for this job. It was unwise of him, in a way, to have done this, because I came across some evidence in letters, and but she took a very strong dislike to Greeks, and particularly educated Greeks, who he called black coats. And it was the old thing that some Greek peasants, you know, high and upstanding people, but educated Greeks, Levantines or whatever, what have you. And he really should never have applied for the job, but he was the outstanding candidate, was appointed to the chair, which he held for 5 years. He's not mentioned in any of the histories of the college. In my book, there's quite a lot about him, and also this other book. Burroughs had naively offered the Greek, rich London Greeks, mainly from descended from people from the island of Chios. They were known as the Anglesochiotes, and so they, I think they were responsible for the chair being called the Choreis chair. And Principal Burroughs had offered them what was basically a chair he conceived as a chair of propaganda, sophisticated academic propaganda on behalf of Greece's irredentist ambitions and on behalf of Venizelos in particular, because he was very much associated with these grandiose expansion ideas of a greater Greece. Toynbee, very soon after taking the chair, travelled in Asia Minor, witnessed some serious atrocities committed by the Greek army in Asia Minor, because the Greeks naturally assumed that any professor of modern Greek studies would be a sympathetic person. The Turks had the sense to keep him well away from their front lines, and where equally nasty things were happening. But the rich Anglesochiotes, they felt betrayed by Toynbee because he was basically siding with the enemy. He had an emotional attachment, really, to Ataturk and the Turkish nationalists. And in a sense, all hell broke out because the Greek community were putting pressure on the university to fire him. The principal of the college at that time stood by him on the grounds of academic freedom, but eventually his position became intolerable, and he took an involuntary resignation from the chair. So the chair got off to a very bad start. It was intended to be a chair focusing on the modern history of Greece, as its title suggests, but it included the section on Byzantine history, and the college, more or less ever since the Toynbee fracas, between 1919 and 1924, has only appointed, until very recently, Byzantinists on the grounds that there would be no trouble. But in fact, there was trouble.
So this stimulates in your mind a keen interest in endowed chairs at British universities, which are funded by external donors. Mm. But part of the book is also a recollection of your period at King's,
yeah,
and applying for the Choreis chair.
Yes.
And what you feel are the... tell us what happened. You applied for the Choreis chair at King's in the...
Yes. And, I think the best word to use is a Greek word. There was a kind of combina, sort of plot, to secure the chair for a Byzantinist. That didn't happen. I've never quite understood why it didn't happen, but they were certainly going to have someone with dangerous interest in Greek politics and history, because it's difficult to, as many people in the audience would know, that you can soon get yourself in hot water by adopting, supporting one cause or another in Greece. So that never transpired, and I decided, really, I had a lot of material to use. I didn't keep a diary, but I kept a mass of paperwork, and I was able to reconstruct the whole story. And just one point I would make about this book is almost entirely based on papers I found in the archive at King's College.
Right.
There's massive material.
But in relation to your own case, you feel that the process of pointing to the Corrèze chair in the 1990s?
Yes, the late 1980s.
The late 1980s, apologies. That the process was inappropriate. It's rather England playing football, and we say that actually the referee, it was fixed, kind of thing.
Yes, I mean, that's one way one might describe it, but certainly, I mean, the two external experts who were supposed to, be relatively objective in their deliberations, they were both Byzantinists. There was no effort to have a kind of even playing field. And what I thought was rather sinister in a way, that thanks to the Freedom of Information Act, some years after the failure to appoint me, I inquired of the college authorities whether there was any documentary material relating to the appointment, because there was a book's worth for this in 1919.
Yes.
But the answer I had was, because they had to answer a Freedom of Information request, that only one single document had been preserved. Now, what had happened to the others? I mean, but we see this generally. I mean, the various institutions, tend to destroy papers that could potentially be embarrassing. And I had another experience
I saw on, I don't know whether it's a website or on social media, apologies, this table is now rocking. I saw on the news websites that Avril Cameron had read your book, Dame Avril Cameron.
Oh, yes.
And if I remember correctly, she was on the appointing committee, which decided to appoint someone else to the Corrèze chair.
Yeah.
And I guess in the interest of balance, I should say that she says, Richard invites the reader to see dark forces at work. He tells a titillating story, she was on your appointing committee, and she says the real history was very different, quite banal, in fact. The committee was unanimous, its decision. You tell a titillating story, quote, but you hurt individuals and you hurt institutions. You add 2 + 2 and you make 5.
I don't quite understand that, but anyway, yes.
Give us a response. How is, I suppose the basic point is that, in the interest of balance, is that Avril Cameron is speaking as someone who was on the committee.
Yes.
You write at considerable length in the book about how the process went off track.
Yes.
It was inappropriate. There was something shady about the selection procedure, which ends with them appointing Roderick Beaton rather than yourself. She's on the appointing committee, and she says she's in a position to know. There aren't the papers. You've only got access to one paper. And she says, Richard, it's not shady. It's actually tremendously banal, and we all agreed. Where's the problem?
Well, first of all, I did have access to many of the papers. I felt sometimes in the books that are streaming out and published in the US, and people unraveling Trump, so to say. I was doing a single-handed job and got some very interesting material that really indicated more or less what was going on. But agreed to take part in this, I decided I wouldn't mention any particular person by name. I'm always impressed by the speed with which Greek students acquire an excellent knowledge of English, but they may not know this expression, no names, no pack drill, which is rather an archaic expression, an army expression. That you might shop one of your mates senior officer, but on the ground, on conditions you wouldn't mention names, and therefore you wouldn't have several hours of drill.
Okay.
So I do. There we are.
What struck me is that in the book you mention a lot of names.
Yes.
Let me jump to another case because. You develop a very serious interest in, as I say, externally funded posts, senior posts at British universities. And you develop a discussion about whether such external philanthropy is impacting in terms of the autonomy of institutions and the appointments procedure of institutions. And you also refer to the LSE. You refer to the Venizelos chair, which I currently hold, but you refer to my predecessor, Lucas Tsoukalis.
Yes.
And you say that...
This is not a no names, no pack drill.
Yeah, well, okay, but it's a general thought. Yeah, but in the book, names are very vividly portrayed.
Yes.
You say that it was odd that the chair was open to various social science subjects but not history. You find it odd that the school decided on a shortlist of only two.
Which I still think was odd.
But then I suppose...
That was the first time, not when you applied, but...
Yeah.
Or did you?
Obviously, I didn't know. Later on, they made a perfect decision when I was appointed, but...
Was there only one applicant?
No, there were many. When I applied, there was a shortlist of five.
I'm sure that was the case.
But when the first appointment was made, I guess what didn't come through from the book was that clearly the LSE decided to create a different kind of chair.
Yeah.
And that is that it was to be located in the European Institute.
Yeah.
So the idea was that it was always going to be Greece and...
Yeah.
Greece and Europe in some respect. So in that context, having a shortlist, which you refer to in the book as Lucas Tsoukalis and Pascalis Kitramalidis.
No, there was a shortlist of two initially.
Yes, so having a shortlist...
Then three, but was the other person other than Pascalis and other than Lucas... was Yorgo Coppolos, I think. Was it Yorgo Coppolos?
I've forgotten.
An economist.
Ah, yes.
These were the first two. Okay. Yes.
But
then at the last minute,
Giddens
decided that didn't look very good from the LSE's point of view. so they better have one or two more.
Right.
And Pascal Zucchetti-Millie, this was asked to apply. I think he hadn't applied because he felt he was too much of a historian in a way. And they were, as you pointed out, they'd omitted history.
Yes.
Because, you know, this is rather crude observation, but politics often in Britain is really rather indistinguishable from contemporary history. It's changing now, and there's more of a disciplinary difference.
But presumably, at a more general level, it's not unreasonable that a university decides that we'll appoint in this area as opposed to that.
So. Yes.
Placing a chair on contemporary Greece in a European institute and giving preference to economists or political scientists and thinking that the appointment would be of someone who would teach Greece and the European Union, etc. That to me seems a really rather legitimate strategic choice.
I accept that.
But you rather imply in the book that the appointments, the shortlisting, the decision not to include contemporary history was slightly suspicious.
Well, I I'm sticking basically to my no names, no pacto, but there was one very good historian, not me, an excellent historian who would have been capable of holding that chair, and I may be wrong, but I think there was possibly no mention of historians for fear that he or she, I'll mystify on he or she, but might apply, but. Just on a general point, I think, we historians in particular, or academics, hardly ever study our own affairs in an academic way, which I hope I do, at least in this book. That one is more of a personal
recollection.
Yeah. But. And academic institutions are extremely secretive about their affairs and make access to their archives difficult. I had this experience when writing the book about Toynbee. I needed to look at the papers of the Board of Studies in History. In the university. Do these boards of study still exist? No, probably not.
The equivalents.
The equivalent. There were about 39 boards of studies, and I wanted to look at the Board of Studies in History, check something. And this was in about 1985, and I wanted to look at proceedings of the Board of Studies for the early 1920s. And I went along to the university archive in Senate House and asked, the archivist asked me what I wanted to see. I said, Minister of the Board of Studies for 1922 to 1924. And she threw her hands up in shock. She said, you can't see those. And I said, why? They are closed for 100 years. This is absolutely incredible. I think they have now changed it, part because I agitated. I mean, even the affairs of the MI6 are open after 100 years. I mean, but minutes of the Board of Studies, these were about appointment of examiners, and mundane things. What conceivably, after 70 or 80 years, could they be regarded as sensitive? And there are many other instances. and I mentioned this one, that they only kept one document from 1980. So anyone, you know, in 50 years' time wanting to write about the history of the Corinth chair will find absolutely nothing. Right. Well, they'll find this one document, that's right. All they
so there's an issue about universities being more secretive than MI5, as it were.
Yes.
Obviously, for good reason. Obviously, for good reason. More important matters. But there's also a theme here which you develop very nicely in the book about the challenges for institutions when accepting external donations external chairs. Yes. Can I clarify, you're not arguing against the receipt of philanthropic donations, it's perhaps the terms under which it's accepted. Do you want to expand on that?
Yes, this is particularly true, of course, in the case of the humanities now, which the government has withdrawn support for, and subjects will only survive if philanthropic institutions put up money for it. This has happened with the recent appointment of Rory Beaton's successor just this year.
Yes.
Unless there'd been very large handouts from the Nearchos Foundation and the Lavendish Foundation, the chair might well have collapsed. But and there's no indication that either the Nearchos Foundation or the Lavendish Foundation would try and manipulate things. But there is some evidence that the Onassis Foundation does sometimes get involved, and there's this curious tale, which I go into in the book, of the Onassis Center at NYU, New York University, which blew up, imploded, rather in a similar fashion to the Corinth chair
Pondicherry. Do you think in the humanities, perhaps in specific areas of the humanities, the survival rests on such philanthropic support?
I think it does, really. To come closer to home, when one thinks of the Saif al-Islam.
Gaddafi.
Gaddafi situation. That would make a brilliant book if anyone could get hold of all the papers.
Absolutely.
And there is.
Saif Gaddafi might write it himself someone else write it for him.
For him. Well, that seems to have happened with. Anyway, I don't want to go into that. But it's quite extraordinary what happened. And there is this marvelous report by Lord Wolfe, who I was very nearly a Symmathetes to Richard in Greece. It's a very interesting relationship. Wolfe was a bit older than me. I'm about 1 year I missed being a schoolmate of him, although he would have been an older boy and not have anything to do with small fry like me. But it's a very interesting and detailed thing. You can get it on the internet, and it's simply amazing what the LSE was prepared to put up with in the hope of getting money. One of the outcomes of the whole scandal was that the LSE adopted a new principle that they wouldn't accept donations from people who were writing theses at the LSE until they'd finished writing and they'd been examined.
Yes.
In other words, they couldn't...
For
current students.
Yes.
Which would seem to be self-evident. But
yes. But in terms of a general principle, as you say, you recognize that philanthropic giving may support key areas of the less fashionable subjects of the yes. humanities, etc. You moved to Oxford, and one of the things which you mentioned very transparently in the book is that you also engage in fundraising for your own position at Oxford.
That's where this this article you referred to really got it rather wrong. I was raising money really for a successor.
Ah, okay, for a successor.
No, because it was a fortunate coincidence. John Campbell, a distinguished yes. anthropologist and historian, he retired just at the moment when I was in some difficulty at King's, and I was able, thanks to Ralph Dahrendorf, among other things, to follow him, to take care of the history, not of the and anthropology. But then I was in the position of really not needing
funding,
because I had was paid off quite handsomely by
right.
King's.
Right.
And John had had the foresight to marry a very rich South African, and he didn't need the money. So two of us had, for 50 or 60 years, taught
fundraising for a successor
in St. Anthony's, but we neither of us had much need of. So
I should finish soon, but I wanted to pick up two entirely different aspects. One of the things you mention in the book is the reference to the academic area, that you would much prefer to be seen as a specialist in modern in the modern history of Greece
yes.
rather than modern Greek history.
Yeah, yes,
tell
yes.
us why.
Yes, well, this is a bee in my bonnet that I've had for some time. It seems to me that Greece is the only country, we have to say, modern Greece. With capital letters. I mean, if we're looking for books on Paraguay, we don't say modern Paraguay. Least of all do we talk about modern Paraguayans, and so modern Greeks. And then modern Greek, even. I mean, I can mention this book by John Boardman, colleague at Oxford, who wrote a book called The Greeks Overseas. Well, anyone would, about any other country, would think it would, you know, the Italians overseas, or you know, the French overseas, would be about French-Italian migration in recent times, even in recent centuries. But not, Boardman's book is about the Greek colonies of Magna Graecia. I mean, you know, pre-Christian. And, you know, I'm quite interested in the history of the Greek diaspora, but if I was to write a book, I couldn't call it The Greeks Overseas. I'd have to say The Modern Greeks Overseas, which was absurd. My concise history of Greece,
yes.
I wrote two histories, one of which was a short history of modern Greece. And then I had this inspiration to leave out modern. And the second history was called A Concise History of Greece.
Yes.
And that which covers the period 1770, more or less, to the present. So I have sometimes visions of classicists picking up the shelf, taking it, opening it, and this kind of, there's not a word about, well, there's a few words, but not very much about the ancient
well,
world.
I must say, following a similar logic, I'm editing a book which will come out as the Oxford Handbook on Greek Politics, and we decided
Excellent.
Not to call it Modern Greek Politics,
yes.
precisely because there may be some people who look for things more interesting in terms of ancient Greece may buy it,
yes.
and then I don't give
yes.
a damn.
Yes, yes,
at
yes,
least
yes.
they're given the author's royalties, which
yes.
are clearly
yes.
the key thing
yes.
here, really.
Yes.
Final question,
yes. Yes.
Then, Richard. You've had, if I may say, a long but also a very distinguished career writing on Greece in particular. When you look back at your work on Greece,
yeah.
and people pick up a book off the shelves in future years by Richard Klug, which would be the your most favourite book, the one that you would like to be remembered for, and why?
I think it's the concise history. It began as really quite a concise one, but with each successive edition, it's got bigger.
Mm.
And I became very interested, because I had to make the concise history different in certain respects from the short history. And one way I did that was incorporating a lot of illustrations. And I got very interested in sort of representing the history of Greece through illustrations. In some ways, a good picture with a lengthy caption can tell you more about than several pages of rather boring text, you know, that might have appeared in the short history. So, and something I am pleased about is that both books have been used in Greek universities as textbooks, although they weren't written with a Greek audience in mind. But I could give just a final word. I was once asked to contribute a chapter to an encyclopedia, Malleris Paedia or something it was called, and this had 70 contributors, 69 of whom were Greeks. One was non-Greek, and that was me. And guess what subject I was asked to write about Greek history from 1940 until 1985.
Because others were not.
Because, you know, I was not deemed to be particularly well disposed to favor one group or the other. So, I'm pleased that the histories, I mean, surely they must now be being superseded by Greek historians. And there's this really interesting book by Kostas Kostis,
yes.
which is a massive thing, which is and will be available to Greek readers. But anyway,
okay. Yes, finally, open it up to comments and questions. There's colleagues with microphones, so if we could take the gentleman here with the blue pen.
Yeah, Bernard Casey of This Place and Others. I wanted to ask you about your role as an historian of, let's call it more or less, modern Greece.
Okay.
Not quite
back. In inverted commas.
Yes, lots of inverted commas here. And I'm also going to interpret Greece with lots of inverted commas as well.
Yes.
I was interested, actually, that you were LSE Greece and not even LSE Hellenic. But
yes.
I'd just come back from Famagusta.
Oh, yes.
Where I crossed on one of the newest borders. It was only a week old and they were still screwing the crossing point together as I crossed it. 1974, I'm not quite sure where you would have been, but you commented upon 66 and 67, so I wonder whether you could also comment upon the end, and whether you could comment upon your views about where does this thing called Greece start and where does this thing called Greece stop, particularly with reference to places like Cyprus, where certain people have certain views that certain places belong to certain people, whereas they probably don't. So I'll put that to you.
Yeah. Yes.
Okay.
Yes.
Don't you?
Sure. Yeah. I well remember in 1974 thinking that in a way, from the Greek Cypriots' point of view, it was a pity that there was a Labour government at the time, because Callaghan public announcements being made to the very large number of British people living on there, and partly in connection with the bases, but partly for other reasons. And the message that went out was from the Admiral. They were sending an aircraft carrier around the island to pick people up. And the message was, keep your spirits up and your heads down. Well, that didn't seem to be very encouraging. I mean, you know, Britain had these two bases there, it still does. And it's quite extraordinary that it's the only British colonial possession which we vacated only on condition that we had maintained the right to these bases, not for 99 years like Hong Kong or something like that, but in perpetuity. This is quite extraordinary. And so Cyprus never, you know, had a kind of qualified independence. I imagine Cypriots nowadays, perhaps in view of what's happened in Syria and Iraq and in the whole of the Middle East, probably find it rather comforting to have these bases, possibly, or less upset than, I mean, but the principle seemed to be quite wrong, that if you colonize a particular part of the world and then you decolonize, that means you pack up. And
I wanted to ask about Enosis in particular. Yes. So I wanted to ask about the Greeksness of Greeks.
Yes.
And where it got to there.
Yes. When does Greece start with one of the questions, isn't it?
Yeah, where does Greece start with it? Where is Greece? What is this Greece?
Yes, well,
was that ever part of Greece or was somewhere else? Was Alexandria part of Greece or was Smyrna?
Yes. Well, the Greeks have this marvelous expression, ikathemas anatholi, which is virtually impossible to translate into English because it literally means the East as we see it, or the East according to us or something. But I mean, but you know, it's meaningless to say, you know, that in English, but Greece could have been very different in size, and this is what Burroughs was championing during the period of the First World War, that Greece seemed to be poised on a sort of reclaiming more or less the Byzantine Empire. And becoming a tremendous force in the news. Of course, that never happened. But William Miller, who was one of the people that Burroughs wanted to fill Miller with in the Coristia, he had this interesting expression in one of his books, where he said that the Greeks had the appetites of a Russia, but the resources of a Switzerland. And there was something in that. He was very sympathetic to Greek aspirations, but these aspirations were unrealistic. I mean, again, I don't want to get into, thinking of Greece and Cyprus, but whether Cypriots are fully part of the Homogeneous, well, I would say, it's not quite clear, when the Center of Hellenic Studies was set up. The
Hellenic Observatory.
Observatory was set up here. There was some leaflet. I've got all these papers which I'll give us some which referred to, you know, there being, I think, 17,000 Greeks in London or in Britain. But this totally forgot the fact that there are probably 100,000 Cypriots. Mm-hmm. And aren't they Greeks? I mean, you know, it was a curious thing. And there's this huge Greek population. And of course, you know, when the second and third and fourth generations to see, you know, whether they deem themselves as being...
Okay, let's move on.
Yes.
Gentleman here. Could you say who you are?
Yes,
thank you. Paul McGrail, Peace News. I'm wondering, in the context of post-World War II Greek politics, my understanding that that there was continuous American involvement in the elections in the late 40s, and then that was followed by their sponsorship of the junta takeover, and then we have Kissinger involvement in the Turkish invasion of Cyprus. To what extent are these allegations true? I mean, has there always been American CIA subversive involvement in Greek politics?
That's a difficult question to answer. I mean, you know, American policy in certain ways was crass, and one can see why people they were pulling strings, but I'm not really sure that they were or some may have been. I mean, there were elements in the CIA, for instance, Greek Americans in the CIA, you know, who had their own agenda they were trying to push. But I think there's still quite a lot we need to know about that. And there's this tendency in Greece to attribute the Xenos, the Actylos, the foreign fingers pulling all the strings. And it used to be said that it was not the Americans pulling the strings, it was the British until 1947 or so. One could see why people did have this these views, but I'd hesitate to pronounce. There's one thing one could say about President Trump. I don't think he's uttered one single word about Greece or Cyprus. Has he?
Let's simply pray that he doesn't. Okay, I think we've time for one last question, if we'd have a last question before we finish. Okay, we are practically out of time, Richard, but let me remind everyone that there is a wine reception outside, and you can buy this very interesting academic memoir, Greek to Me, a Memoir of Academic Life. Thank you for having the conversation here. Can you please thank Richard Clark?
Thank you. Thank you.